I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, time now for our mailbag segment of the week, one of the favorites on our show. Let's get started with this, Steve Versnick.
Well, we'll start with Jeff, who had tweeted us. He says, will the NFL immediately follow the new CDC guidelines of a five-day quarantine if you're asymptomatic from COVID?
Well, as we do this podcast, this is the morning on Tuesday for today's podcast. And so at this point, there's not been a formal announcement. But yes, I think the NFL has pretty vigorously followed the CDC recommendations when they can. They've kind of instituted what's been a 10-day quarantine for players who test positive, unless you're able to have two negative tests with 24 hours in between and be asymptomatic. So more often than not, players have gone the 10 days for whatever reason, even those that we think are vaccinated. Certainly, if you're unvaccinated, it's a mandatory 10 days that you have to be out. But I do think that this will be welcomed by not just the NFL, but a lot of sports leagues that, we just had a case of Brashard Perryman. Depending on when the test, comes back, if it's midweek, you could potentially miss two games, as he did. He was unable to come back because the 10 days actually carried over two different games. So it was a Monday night game against the Saints, and he was unable to play on Sunday, this past Sunday at Carolina. So, yes, I do believe that this will certainly speed up the time for players to return. They're talking about other things with the NFLPA in terms of whether you test at all a player who is vaccinated. Right now it's once a week. Do you change that to no times a week unless they're symptomatic? So there's all kinds of discussions going on. It's really problematic. If you watch the game Monday night, I mean, that was not a competitive football game. It was not an NFL product, quite frankly. Ian Book, I mean, he's not ready to play quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, particularly when most of his offensive line, or a good portion of it, is not in front of him. So, with games like that, if you project that beyond the next 2 weeks and you get into the postseason and you start to have players missing, particularly if there were a 10-day incubation period and stuff like that, I just don't see that as a good product. And they don't want to move games. They don't want to reschedule games. TV is king. They've done that a couple times, but if they're going to do it, they have to be consistent with it. And I don't. I think obviously the intention is not to move them, particularly if it's postseason, which we're just a couple weeks away from. So, yes, a welcome reprieve from the CDC saying that 5-day quarantine is sufficient.
All right, Scott had tweeted, the Carolina Panthers announced a bunch of new COVID cases on Monday. How does this affect the Bucs, and will they all be testing more because of it?
This has come up a couple times. If you recall, the Bucs were in training camp, had a couple of days of workouts with the Tennessee Titans, who spent like 4 days here in the state of Florida, and a whole bunch of Titans players and coaches, some of whom the Bucs were around, including Ryan Succop, who did get COVID because he had gone to dinner with a special teams coach from Tennessee who he knew. And so, you wonder, while they're scrimmaging against each other, playing against each other, if it's transmissible. I haven't seen that to be the case necessarily. Like, we know the Bucks have some guys, as of Tuesday morning, some more have gone into the protocol, including their coach, the receivers coach, Kevin Garber, Mike Evans, Jalen Darden was in there last week. We'll see if he makes it back by Sunday. And so you could have these little pockets of outbreaks by positions and things like that. But when the Titans incident occurred, there really wasn't any, even though they scrimmaged with them 4 days, there really wasn't an uptick in positive cases with the Bucs. And I don't know that there has been between opponents. I don't have great research on that off the top of my head, but I can't remember, oh, this team just played that team, and now both teams are you know, have a ton of cases. So we'll wait and see. It's not a good thing. But it's just that, you know, in the case of the Titans, they were in a hotel. They went to dinner. They were moving around. And so, you know, they were probably exposed at that time. This was in August to a lot more potential infection than the Bucs, who were, you know, pretty much home and work during training camp. So, again, I think the more you do, the more people move around, the more they could get with parties, or as the weather turns cooler up north, you know, go inside, stuff like that. Especially with this Omicron variant, it's just incredibly contagious. Not as the symptoms not as severe, particularly for people with good immunities or with vaccinations. But I don't sense yet that, you know, the increased cases in Carolina is also going to be duplicated here in Tampa. Not yet.
All right, John had tweeted us, and this is regarding Shaq Barrett. He goes, "This isn't the first time this year a Bucs player re-entered the game when they had a somewhat serious injury. Obviously, if you ask the guys, they want to play, but is it something the training staff should review?"
Absolutely, and I have not talked with Bobby Slater. I have not talked with some of the guys over there, Alex Guerrero, whoever is you know, sort of evaluating these injuries. You would start there, obviously, with the trainer, Bobby Slater. And you have team doctors there as well. It's not limited to just the trainers. But they take them in those blue tents and they evaluate, you know, in the case of both Shaq Barrett and even Chris Godwin. I mean, Chris Godwin clearly was hit on the knee. At best, it was hyperextended. They told us the next morning it was an MCL sprain. They taped him back up and had him running on the sidelines before they realized it wasn't good. In the case of Shaq Barrett, he went back into the game and played and then came out and was out for the game. I get the mentality of football players playing hurt, but there's a big difference between being hurt and being injured. And, you know, God forbid, and I'm not saying this is the case, but, you know, let's hope Chris Godwin had a torn ACL before he tried to sprint on the sidelines and did more damage to it. Let's hope that Shaq Barrett, who has a sprained ACL and MCL, and a sprained ACL is rare. Let's hope he didn't do more damage to himself by going back into the football game. I'm a little concerned, or I would be if I were a player, to find out that they were willing to put me back out there and I was injured. And again, not pointing the finger necessarily, don't know what the risk was to these guys, but it just seems to me that if a player can't finish a game and he's going to miss multiple games afterwards, probably wasn't a good idea. I'm kind of with the questioner. I think probably wasn't a good idea to say, "Hey, can you go, big guy?" You know what I mean? Like, err on the side of caution in that case, rather than put a guy back out there. Now, guys play hurt all the time. I mean, if you never put a player back on the field once he came out of a game, there wouldn't be any players by the end of the game. Everybody gets beaten up, bruised up at some point. That one was a little, you know, I looked up and there was Shaq Barrett, and I had just written that you know, he was doubtful for the rest of the game or questionable or whatever. And then I look up and there he is, and I'm like, oh, Shaq Barrett is back. And then they announced, as soon as that series was over, or maybe even before, they announced in the press box that Shaq Barrett is out for the game. It's like, well, what was he doing back on the field? So I have these same questions. I don't think you help a player's injury by making him play that way. But if they felt that it was going to do more damage, certainly they wouldn't put him back out there. But we know in the case of Godwin, who tried to run on the sidelines, and then Barrett, who came back in, they did feel like that they were able to try it at least. And, you know, that's a little concerning to me as well. I don't quite understand that, but then I'm not a trainer. I'm not a doctor. I don't have their degrees. I can't really speak intelligently on what the risk of that is once those injuries are big diagnosed. And quite frankly, you know, during the game, when they take those guys in there, they can check the stability of the knee. They can do certain things, right, manipulating it in that blue tent. But without an MRI machine, without being able to, and not an X-ray, because X-rays do bones and things like that, but without actually being able to get an imaging like they get the next morning, you can't really detect the damage to the ligaments in various joints and things like that unless something has popped out of place or you have a torn patella or something like that. It's very difficult sometimes to know what's going on inside there, and that's why these guys all go for MRIs the next morning because they want a better picture. But in real time, during the three-hour game, you know, what equipment do they have available to them at the stadium? It's not what they're getting on Monday morning. So that is to say they probably should always err on the side of caution. And in these cases, I had the same concerns that that the questioner did.
All right, Ryan tweeted us, if Mike Evans stays on the reserve COVID list, does it mean that the Bucs get an extra 53-man spot for the Jets game? If he wasn't going to play anyway, there's a silver lining to this, I guess.
I think it might, yes. And I don't know if it's a silver lining per se. You know, there's a number of guys that they can bring from the practice squad. You know, they have so many guys on IR at this point. And that's why they did put him on IR, because like in the case of Levante David or you know, Leonard Fournette and some others, they felt like they weren't going to be back in these final three games anyway. So let's go ahead and use their roster spots. So they're fairly full now to begin with. You know, you don't dress 53, you know, but, you know, they have enough to choose from. So, like, you know, last week, for example, they carried an extra punter. They elevated him from the practice squad, and he wound up, you know, punting for Bradley Pinion because Pinion, even though active, wasn't able to go because of his hip injury. So, you know, you do have enough wiggle room currently because they have put some guys on IR, so they've activated some players. But yeah, I think in the reserve COVID list, if you're on there, you can pull a player to replace him for that week. So I don't know if it's a blessing in disguise, because quite frankly, most of the guys that can play are already here. They'll get Perryman back, who comes off that list, so it's sort of a one-for-one deal. So I think they'll be okay so long as Perryman comes back. They don't lose anybody else. I wasn't sure Mike was going to play anyway with the hamstring injury. Now, next week, if he's still out, that's a problem for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is he needs 101 yards to get his eighth straight 1,000-yard season. He wants to keep that streak going, so I know that will be important to him, but they have not put him on IR, but they do have other players that you know, that will take his place.
Michael tweeted us, will the Bucs still have playoff Lenny back for the first playoff game?
Great question. I don't think they know. That's one that could be a situation where, you know, he comes back in the second playoff game. If you remember a year ago, you know, they got into a situation in the postseason where I think Antonio Brown got hurt and didn't play against Green Bay in the championship game and came back. So you'll see these guys, you know, miss a playoff game. It was COVID that took out Devin White, I believe, because the game was on Saturday instead of Sunday. He could have played on a Sunday. He missed two games, including the game at Washington, but they won the game and he was able to come back. So we'll just have to see how that falls, but I think that's the plan. You know, they're hopeful that his hamstring will be good and that he'll be able to play in that. Now, you know, is he 100%? Is he going to carry the kind of workload he did during the regular season? I think that's the reason for these final two games, three games, is to give guys like Keyshawn Vaughn, you know, maybe even Le'Veon Bell, certainly Ronald Jones, and let those guys, you know, carry the mail. And when we saw a big play by Vaughn, Ronald Jones ran hard, had a touchdown, 20 carries. Like, get them going so that you don't have to put as much of a workload on Leonard Fournette when he comes back. And it could just be that, you know, last year's playoff Lenny is this year's Ronald Jones. You know, that could happen too. That's why you have multiple running backs that can step up. I thought Vaughn played really, really good. When you go back and watch not just that 55-yard run, but some of the other runs that he made, he looked good. He looked like the game slowed down for him. So they'll have enough running backs. But, yeah, I mean, you know, Fournette was such a big part of this offense, almost 100 yards, you know, from the scrimmage almost every game, that, you know, the idea is to give him as much time as possible. And it could be that he misses one playoff game. I've heard that that might be the case. But they do expect him back at some point in the postseason.
All right, Devon had tweeted us. Can you please explain why the Cowboys are currently a higher seed over the Bucks and Rams when they are each 11-4 and the Bucks won the head-to-head?
Well, the head-to-head doesn't come into play if there's a three-way tie or more, and it goes to conference record. And right now, the Dallas Cowboys have a better – the first tiebreaker is head-to-head if it's a two-team race. But if it's more than two teams, it goes to NFC or the conference record, and the Cowboys have a better one than the Bucks do. So that's the reason why that is the way it is. Now, the Bucks could move up, certainly if the Cowboys were to lose a game, and I think they've got to play the Arizona Cardinals coming up here. They could also move up if the Rams lose. The problem with the Cardinals losing as much as they have of late is that the Rams now look like they're going to win the NFC West. If they do that and if there becomes a two-team tie for one of those NFC seeds, then the Rams would get it because of head-to-head. But I think if the Rams lose a game, regardless of whether they win the division or not, the Bucs have a chance to move up if they win out and win the final two games. There's a whole bunch of different scenarios. I think there's a pretty good chance that Tampa Bay finishes higher than a three seed. They probably won't get the number one seed because I don't see Green Bay losing both games, particularly the last game to Detroit, even though it's at Detroit. So I think Green Bay is fairly entrenched as the number one seed, but the Bucs could improve. And that's part of the dilemma that Bruce Arians faces is that, you know, does he go all in to try to win these next two games, or because it's the Jets and then Carolina at home, at some point does he start to say, look, I'm not going to risk all my guys because we know we got the postseason? And his answer is somewhere in between, because first you got to make sure that you can't improve your playoff position. I mean, we go into the last game and Carolina, a win over them and maybe a coupled with a loss by somebody improves your seeding even one spot, then the Bucks are going to play everybody they can until they think they have the game locked up. There's also the Russ versus rest scenario where, you know, I've seen guys held out and they sort of lose momentum. I think the way you play it is that if you do get to that last game and nothing can be gained, if it's completely you're locked into number three or number four and it doesn't matter who wins or loses that day, I think in that case, you know, maybe, you know, you play it like a preseason game. Guy goes out there for a little bit, gets a little rhythm, comes out as fast as he can, whether that's Tom Brady, you play Blaine Gabbert, anybody, and I mean anybody who is nicked up, a little bit hurt, you know, could do further damage by playing is held out of that game for health reasons primarily. And you just go out there and do the best you can, knowing that it doesn't matter if you win or lose because you can't really improve anything. So my guess is, though, that final game is going to mean something. That it just feels like there's enough teams and enough scenarios and could be, you know, every week there's an upset or two. That the last week of the season, I think, is going to matter. The good news is the Bucks play at 1 o'clock. You know, they won't know what's going to happen to all the 4 o'clock games, but they can sit back and watch. And you know, I don't think they're going to hold players out. I mean, I really sense that Bruce Arians is against that just in general. But you know, the way they've been playing and dropping like flies. I mean, how would you feel if you got into the fourth quarter and Tom Brady got hurt in a game that you had at hand? So they'll get them out as fast as they can, but they're going to try to win both games. That's the plan right now.
All right, Michael had tweeted us, and this is regarding Chris Godwin's injury a while back. Should the NFL change the strike zone for tacklers from below the head to above the knee?
Well, you could do that. I mean, it could be a strike zone similar to what you see in baseball, right? From the letters down to the top of the knees, or the thighs, I guess you would say. But, I will say this about how fast the game is and the difficulty some of these players, particularly defensive backs, have. There's very little opportunity if you're, you know, a 5'10", 195-pound defensive back and Rob Gronkowski is coming around the edge at you. If you go up high against him, you know, Gronkowski is, you know, going to run over you like a truck. So, you know, hitting him at the knees isn't preferred, clearly. It'd be better if you could, you know, ankle tackle him, foot tackle him, whatever. But if you're going to tell me that the guy has to hit him, you know, from the shoulders down to the thighs, that's a tough thing to ask defenses. Although, You know, you can't block a lineman below the waist or at the knees. You can't hit a quarterback at the knees. And this has always been sort of Brady's complaint, is that, you know, how come receivers are still able to be struck there that are defenseless? And so I think that might also be another interpretive rule, that if they do change it, it's going to be to protect the defenseless receiver that's being thrown into harm's way. And here comes the safety or the defensive back running the opposite direction. And, you know, the combination of those physics just don't work out for the guy that gets hit. So maybe they'll say, well, if he's defenseless, you can't go low. You have to be above the knees and below the head. But, man, the game is so fast. I know the players say this. They would much rather be hit in the head. They're 25, 26 years old. They'll worry about their faculties when they're in their 60s. But I'm here to tell you, those head injuries are bad, and they're trying to take it out of the game. It's just that for a guy like Chris Godwin, who makes his living with his legs and was a franchise player and was looking at potentially a long-term $100 million contract or $80 million contract, this is devastating. You know, he has no leverage now on anyone, including the Bucs, and, you know, it might be as late as late September, October before he's even able to play football again. And so, you know, for a guy like that, man, it's just – tell him that he would rather get hit in the knee again. You know, it just doesn't work. But I don't know what they can do to change it, because I just think there are some matchups that are so hard that you're going to get defensive backs that are just going to be, you know, defenseless against bringing down some of these bigger players if they can't hit them, you know, below the waist or something like that. So I don't have a great answer. I think if you just limit it to, you know, if you rule a guy a defenseless receiver and you take his knees out, if that's a flag, I would probably back that. But that puts, again, more onus on the officials in a game that they're having trouble keeping up with now. The officiating's not great. They're not even full-time. There's a lot of problems with that whole side of the equation. Why the NFL, which is a multi-billion, you know, billions and billions of dollars, can't pay guys to work full-time as officials, I have no clue. Makes no sense to me. I wouldn't care who they're going to lose, because some guy's a good official, but he's a lawyer back in Sacramento. I don't care. Get your full-time officials in here and help them call games. But right now, it's too fast for them. And the more you add in terms of strike zones and things like that, man, it's going to create more reviews and all of that. The headshots and stuff, I think they've got pretty well down. Those rules are good. But, you know, implementing that in the knees might be difficult.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, Narendra tweeted us. Rick, who is the most memorable coach you've ever covered, and why was his name Greg Schiano?
So we're answering our own question here, huh? Memorable. Memories like the corners of my mind, misty, watered, colored memories. You know, they're all memorable, to be honest with you, because I was at a different part of my life, you know, and each time I encountered these gentlemen, and there's been a bunch, to say the least. I mean, starting with Ray Perkins, who was, you know, intimidating is what I would say about him. You know, succeeded Bear Bryant at Alabama, could stare at you, could stare holes in you. You know, brutally unfair sometimes to players that he would cut and punish physically before cutting them. I've talked about those stories before. You know, and I mean, listen, I think you'd be hard. You know, Sam Weich was a character. I think you'd be hard to top Tony Dungy just in that time period, which was sort of a Camelot time period, the actual turning around of a franchise that had lost, you know, 10 games or more for so many consecutive years, couldn't win on the West Coast, couldn't win in the cold, couldn't win anywhere. And, you know, to see him go to the playoffs 4 out of 6 years, get them to an NFC championship game on the brink of a Super Bowl that John Gruden came in, you know, and actually completed. Gruden, we know, is one of the biggest characters of the game, despite his horrible fall from grace, you know, with the text messages and whatnot, whatever's going on now after he was let go by the Raiders. And yeah, Greg Schiano was different, man. He was different, you know, toes on the line, blowing the whistle. But at the time, that's what the Bucs felt they needed after Raheem Morris, who was another character. And I think a really good coach, and I think Raheem Morris will be a head coach again in this league, maybe as early as this next year. But he was 32 years old, and he was completely unprepared for the role and did the best he could. He even had a 10-6 season with I challenge you to go back and look at the talent on a team and tell me how they won 10 games, which is very rare in this organization's history, as you know, as we sit here with back-to-back 11-win seasons. It's never happened before. So they've all been unique. You know, you'd be hard to top Dungy just in, again, in terms of what he represented, the time that he coached. But biggest character was probably John Gruden. You know, biggest, you know, most sort of every day the building was on fire was probably when Greg Schiano was there. It wasn't all of his doing. And, again, the most intimidating was definitely Ray Perkins in some ways. So they've all had their flavor, but I can't say there's just one. If you pin me to one, it would probably be Tony Dungy again. More about turning around the franchise, you know, Brooks and Lynch and Sapp were all drafted by Sam Weich, but it was Dungy that put them in the positions that they needed to be in to have that historic run of defense. And you know, three of those guys now are in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So, you know, to me, it was the Dungy era that I think about when I think about the coaches that I've covered. That was probably the most enjoyable as well.
Didn't you cover Steve Spurrier at Florida as well?
You know, I didn't. I only covered him for a couple. Yeah, it was funny because, you know, I had been there 2 years, and it was an absolute – wherever I go, tragedy happens. I don't know why. But we wrote a whole bunch of stories. They both the basketball and the football program got on probation. Galen Hall was fired 5 games into one season, and I think they were 5-0 at the time. They appointed Gary Darnell. That was my last year there. Norm Sloan, you know, had all the trouble with Vernon Maxwell and paying agents and whatnot, and he had his basketball media day and was pointing us all out and yelling at us, and then a couple days later he was fired. They're going to put him in front of a grand jury and accuse him of perjury if the University of Florida didn't do something. So Spurrier came in. I remember we were there at the Freedom Bowl, and they had the interim coach, and the Gators were actually in the process of hiring Spurrier from Duke that weekend. And he did come in, and I was still covering the beat like in February or March, and they had a quarterback named Donald Douglas who played at the end of the final season that I covered them, and he was not a great quarterback. I remember against Auburn, Emmett Smith ran the ball like, you know, 30 times. They attempted 5 passes and damn near beat Auburn at Auburn one game. But Douglas was, you know, Spurrier didn't like him as a quarterback and was going to move him to safety or some other position. And so Douglas decided to transfer. And I found out about it. And since he was their starting quarterback, he was going to the University of Houston because he was from Houston. So I wrote a story about it, and I called Spurrier, or actually Spurrier called me, and kind of got on my case a little bit. And it's my only interaction I had with him at the time. He's like, "Ah, Steve Spurrier appeared just to want to let you know some good things going on here at University of Florida. Seems like you wrote a negative story. Negative story. It's just, you know, got a lot of good things going on up here." And I was like, "Well, you know, the guy transferred. He said, what was wrong with the story? He said you didn't want to play quarterback. Well, we're gonna try to play him somewhere else, but you know, he transferred. That's his decision. I just want to let you know it's not good things going on up here." So that was my one and only interaction. And then, of course, he took over, won national championship, and everything was great. But I hear, because a good friend of mine is Chris Harry, has an unbelievable relationship with Spurrier, I hear that if you get inside that circle, he was a lot of fun. And certainly he brought a lot of the fun and gun to university. Those were the great days at Florida that I missed. I had the dark days, which seemed to follow me wherever I go. But, yeah, no, I didn't get to enjoy the Spurrier years.
I think you left off one coach that you covered twice, sort of.
Who's that?
Bill Parcells.
Yeah, well, Bill almost made it to the Alta. He left us at the Alta. I don't know if people remember the great late Hugh Culverhouse, but man, that was a memorable day too. When, you know, back in after the 90 season when Ray was fired, Richard Williamson was the interim coach for a couple days and a couple games, and they had been trying to hire Bill Parcells the first time. This was Culverhouse, not the Glazers, who then did it again, Culverhouse, we went over, it had been a long search, and it looked like it was going to happen. And the late, great Will McDonough, who was, you know, worked for NBC, I think, and was on with Bob Costas, they called us over for a press conference, and it was supposed to be to introduce Parcells. And so we're like, finally, this search is over. It's going to be Parcells. And I walk into the building, and Will McDonough is on the TV, and he's talking to Bob Costas. He says, "Bob, I just found out that Bill Parcells is not coming to Tampa Bay. He's going to stay, you know, with whatever network he was working for." And I was like, oh, my God, what are we walking into? And it was like you went to somebody's funeral. And so Culverhouse got up there, and he was crestfallen because he literally had called the press conference. And Parcells got cold feet, pulled out, and he stood up there, and he goes, "Well, I'm here for the wedding. But for the record, there's no honeymoon." And he started waving like a bunch of, like, "I got 32 points that I signed off on. Anything from you know, coaches' cars and contracts to everything he wanted." And he, you know, he was just, he goes, "I'm left at the altar." So the runaway bride was Bill Parcells that time. And then, unbelievably, they fired Tony Dungy. For 2 weeks, they had been talking to Bill Parcells, had a contract. I wrote this story, broke this story before Tony Dungy ever coached his last game. They're up in Philadelphia. Story comes out on Saturday. The game's on Sunday, I believe. They lose the game badly. Tony's fired. And there's so much pushback to Bill Parcells. And he was going through a divorce, which might have factored into whatever earnings he was going to make. But he had his entire coaching staff. They were keeping the defensive staff, Monty Kiffin, all those guys. Wrote the whole story, knew his staff, knew everybody. And he left them at the altar again. And, you know, the Bucks denied it at the time. "No, we didn't have a deal, blah, 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 blah." Restarted the search. The second time they ended up with Tony Dungy, as a matter of – no, John Gruden. John Gruden. Is that right? What am I thinking of? Yeah, it was John Gruden that they ended up with, because they were going to get Parcells after Dungy was fired. They ended up with John Gruden, that they made the trade for him, but that was like a month later. And Parcells then the next offseason came out of the ESPN and signed with the Dallas Cowboys as a coach. The Bucks and the Glazer family produced a signed contract, gave it to the NFL, and said, "We deserve a draft pick for compensation." The NFL told them, "Get out of here. You didn't really sign that, coach," even though they had his contract. So after denying that they didn't have a deal with Bill Parcells, a year later when he went to Dallas, the Glazers popped out a contract and said, "Yeah, we did. Here it is right here." Crazy stories.
All right, Narendra had a follow-up question and asked, "What's the favorite present that you or I received this year?"
Wow. Do you do presents, Steve? Like, my wife and I kind of buy, you know, our own stuff throughout the year. I did give my wife some things that she wanted. Mm-hmm. My favorite present, well, I had gotten a pair of shoes that I wanted, and it turned out they didn't feel good on my feet after I wore them for a while, so that was out the window. I don't know.
My wife and I pretty much, it's like, we'll buy something and say, "Here, give this to me."
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, I get a list. And so I, you know, I'm at the mall on Christmas Eve, you know, running around getting stuff. At this age, you know, it's all about the kids. And, mm-hmm. I just wish I'd have spent more time with them on Christmas Day. I had to travel to Charlotte, but no, I can't say I got something that was just my, you know, just, you know, knockout favorite, typical dad, you know, new razor, stuff like that. But yeah, there's really nothing this year. Yeah. How about you?
At my son's school, they have a holiday shop that you give them some money,
yes,
and they go buy gifts. And you have a budget and everything. So
yeah,
both of my sons got me the same MVP dad, like,
there you go,
desk plate that you put up. So it was funny. They both picked the same ones without knowing.
Without knowing the other one picked it.
Yeah. So as we open at Christmas, you know, each one Christmas morning. Yeah. Got that. So
those are great. Mm-hmm. Those are great. My youngest does that still. And I think this year she goes, Dad, I didn't know what to get you. She got me a pair of sunglasses. I said, well, that's good. You can always use those.
Absolutely.
Cool.
We're in Florida.
But I've gotten the best dads and the trophies and things like that, which is always cool. But yeah, those are the best is when your kids pick something out for you from the school store or stuff like that, or make something for you. Mm-hmm. Ornaments. My daughter made an ornament with her picture on it this year in school, which was that's probably the best gift we got. So, yeah.
I remember the first time my oldest son did the holiday store at school. We didn't really know what it was. So mm-hmm. we gave him like, $15 or something, and he bought five gifts or something.
Right.
And when he came back and as he's showing us the gifts for everybody, mm-hmm. it was the amount of thought he had put into each one.
Right.
Like, they're kindergartners. And he's like, well, I got this for grandma because her favorite color is purple and this. It was like, wow, that's really cool. So now we give them a lot more money and let them, have more fun with it because you see just how thoughtful they can be with that.
They are thoughtful.
There was reason for everything they did.
Yes. Because their options are, it's not the mall, right? I mean, it's a limited amount of items they can mm-hmm. buy. And so they really want to be selective and they try to, like you said, they try to put thought into it, which is really cool that they do that. But, and then sometimes they get like, well, I just didn't know what to get you or that sort mm-hmm. of thing. But it's anything homemade, any ornaments, things like that for me, because we have pictures that are there, ornaments that are hanging on the tree from different years. And you can watch them literally grow on your tree. It's just really cool. So, yeah, with kids, it's usually stuff like that. But anyway, great questions today. We'll be back out at One Buck Place to see if they have any players left to play at New York against the Jets this Saturday. Sunday, the COVID list continues to grow. Hopefully not much more. And I don't know if anybody else is injured or not, but we'll keep you up to date on that. Check it out on TampaBay.com. And, of course, we'll recap the Lightning's effort against the Montreal Canadiens. Limited as it is with their players with COVID as the NHL tries to restart its season. So that's going to be something to watch as well. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for your questions. For Steve Burstnick, I'm Rick Stroud of the Tampa Bay Times. Have a great day, everybody.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.